Hello, everyone, and welcome to another interview session at the Innovation and Creativity Summit 2017. We're very happy to have Drew Boyd with us today, author of Inside the Box, and an expert in systematic creativity and a take on outside the box thinking. Drew, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Drew, why don't you give our watchers and listeners a quick insight into how you got into the field of creativity and innovation?
Yeah, great. It's a great question. I feel like I've been in this field for a very long time. As I look back on my career, I've always been sort of the creativity minded, but I've always been in search of what is it that helps you really produce an idea. And my background, even though I'm an academic, traditional academic now, in the sense that I teach creativity and strategy and other topics at the University of Cincinnati. My background is really corporate. I spent over 30 years in large organizations. Most recently, I was with the healthcare company Johnson & Johnson, and that's where I really learned a lot about innovation, creativity, because we had such a mandate to try to grow through innovation that we were pressured to really try many innovation methods out there. And my God, I have spent millions of dollars. We've done so many different things. And that's where I learned to really understand the landscape of innovation and creativity, with the specific liking for what I've written a book about since with my co-author. And that's what I teach now, this idea of systematic innovation, systematic creativity. So it's more of a corporate background now mixed with academic, and the two come together very nicely. And I spend my time doing what I love.
And what people outside of your clients probably know you best for is your book, Inside the Box, which is a cheeky take on this idea of what everyone says you need to do during brainstorming sessions, which is think outside the box.
Yeah.
So why do people have this concept of a box? Tell us a bit more about that.
So it's a fascinating story. I never knew this until we started writing this book. My co-author is Dr. Jacob Goldenberg, and I'll tell you more about him in a minute. But what most people believe is that to be creative, you have to think outside the box. And everybody's heard that phrase. It's become the universal catchphrase for all creativity. There's just one problem. The idea is flawed. In fact, it's flat out wrong. And what I point to is the research about this phrase and the research that followed it that disproved it. So here's where that idea comes from, Nick. You may have seen a famous puzzle. It's called the 9-dot puzzle. It's a puzzle because it has three dots in a row, three rows of three dots in the form of a box. And the task is you have to take your pencil, and with just four straight lines, you have to connect all nine dots without lifting your pencil. And it's tricky, unless you know the trick. And if you know the trick is you have to extend your line outside the box to give yourself an angle to come down and complete the puzzle, breaking the bonds of the traditional mental box that you put around these dots. This puzzle was used in the 1970s by a researcher named P.J. Guilford. And when he administered this puzzle, only 20% of people could solve it. And so he coined the phrase, if you could just think outside the box, you can be more creative. Well, here's the problem. Two other researchers right after Guilford did the same study, same puzzle, same conditions, but they added a second group. The first group got the same instructions as the first group, with Guilford gave his people. The second group got the instructions that to solve the puzzle, you had to draw your lines outside the box created by the nine dots. Well, in the first group, the control group, again, 20% could solve a puzzle. But what do you think happened in the second group, Nick? What would be your...
It must have skyrocketed, like much higher.
Yeah, that's what you think. Guess what? 20%.
What? Really? Okay.
Yes, really. 20%, no change whatsoever. So sadly, this idea of thinking outside the box is a complete myth. And think about it. When you tell somebody to think outside the box, what are you really saying? What happens when the mind goes out into this vast, unconstrained space, it overwhelms the mind. The mind suffers what we call idea anarchy or idea chaos. It looks and looks and looks unsuccessfully and drags down as a result. And people are very frustrated. And this is why brainstorming, 50 years of research has shown that brainstorming doesn't work. Now, I know some of your reader, listeners today, your watchers or audience is not going to like that. I didn't like that when I first heard it until I read the data. So don't shoot the messenger, folks. it's a flawed tool. There's some great research out there that explains why it's flawed. Sadly, it continues to be used today, I think, because people just don't know otherwise what to do instead. But it doesn't work. In fact, not only does brainstorming not work, it actually works against you. If you wanted to do one thing to make yourself more innovative, I would tell you to stop using brainstorming. So it goes very much against what the traditional notion of what people have been used to.
So why then would you still talk about thinking inside the box if this box myth exists?
Yeah, good question. Because the name of the book is Thinking Inside the Box. And here's the story. It turns out that based on research by my co-author, Dr. Jacob Goldenberg, he did an interesting thing. He studied highly innovative products initially to find out what made them different from one another. What he found instead is that they have more in common, that they tend to follow patterns. And these patterns are in the majority of innovative products you see around you. And what we believe is that for thousands of years, everyday inventors, innovators, have used patterns in their inventions, usually without knowing it. And in doing so, they've embedded those patterns into the products and services you see around you. Think of the patterns as the DNA of a product or service. And what this method is, and what we've seen over and over works, is that if you apply these patterns in this tightly constrained environment inside the box, your mind works harder and smarter. The patterns essentially channel your ideation. They guide your cognition for you. They force you to create an idea. And this is why the method called systematic inventive thinking, or SIT for short, is so effective. It's certainly the most effective thing I've found. I can't find anything that works more consistently with better ideation than this. And this is what the topic of the book is about. It teaches the method. As it turns out, there's five patterns. There's probably more patterns, but these five tend to be the most prevalent that you'll see out in the world. And the book teaches people how to use these patterns.
I'm really interested to find out a bit more about systematic inventive thinking. Is that right?
Yep.
Okay. Yeah, just before that, one thing that just came to mind as you were talking about this setting constraints for the mind. It's something I talk about with my clients as well, but quite often what I talk about is from a strategic concept. When you ask people in a company to form ideas, quite often the best ideas come when they are given guidelines about what actually constitutes a good idea. And that's when the people in the company set out essentially the borders of the box that these ideas need to fit into.
You're exactly right. We call those constraints or criteria.
Yeah.
And when I work with a client, the first thing we do is we establish what are the criteria, and what are the constraints. And clients will say, oh, no, we don't want any constraints. We want all options considered. And you know what I say to them, Nick? No constraints, no project. Yeah. Because I mean, without constraints, your project's going to fail. Constraints or criteria indeed do form the box. Think about it. Does it make sense to generate ideas that are outside the criteria? No, it's a waste of time. So you're absolutely on the right track. And when I see teams struggle pretty much on anything, even a husband and wife, when they struggle, it's because they're using different criteria. And so when I bring teams together and I start working with them, I see them debating things and I go, timeout is the term we use in American football, probably other sports. And timeout means let's sit down and talk about the criteria, because if you can't agree on the criteria, you'll never agree on the big issue. But if you can agree on the criteria and maybe your assumptions, then you're much more likely to agree and resolve and get yourself on a productive path.
Not only that, but I can't remember exactly who wrote the research, but there's also research out there suggesting that there's few things that hinder creativity more than a completely blank slate or a completely blank piece of paper.
That's the point with a completely blank, and I've seen teams do this all the time. They call it white space. You know, let's go after white space. White space is very frustrating. When I would be invited to these, I always found a convenient way to slip out of it because I knew it was doomed. It was doomed without these constraints. And that is a cornerstone of the SIT method, the principle of constraints. Constraints are a necessary condition for creativity to happen. Creativity is virtually impossible without some type of constraint. And you can see it in all walks of life, not just corporate business innovation, but things in music or art. I play guitar. You can see one of my guitars here in the background. And I love the story by a famous jazz guitarist named Bill Frisell. And what Bill does to stimulate his mind for creative riffs is he imagines he can only play on one string, let's say the high E string. And so he forgets the other five strings and just forces himself to make great music on one string. Well, it turns out that's one of the patterns. It's called the subtraction pattern. But it's also a great example of how he's constraining his mind, this idea of the box, by using just one string. And you see examples of this all over the place.
So can we go into a bit more detail on the SIT method? How would you actually go about using this in the team, and what are those five patterns that you were talking about?
Sure. I'll explain the patterns. Let me explain an important premise that you have to buy into to understand this method. The method, Nick, is five what we call techniques that are the pattern-based techniques and a set of principles. One principle we've already discussed, the principle of constraints. Let me explain another principle, probably maybe one of the most important ones. The traditional view of innovation or creativity is that you have to start with a problem and then you brainstorm or do whatever to create a solution, problem to solution. Well, what if I told you could flip those? What if I told you could start with a solution and work backwards to the problem that it solves? Now, it may sound crazy, but guess what? Humans are actually better at that direction than the other direction.
Okay.
Let me prove it to you. I want you to imagine I'm holding a baby's milk bottle. This milk bottle changes color when the temperature of the milk changes. So, Nick, tell me, why would that be useful?
Either it would be, I don't have kids, so I haven't used that many milk bottles, but either probably if you're heating up milk before you give it to the baby, that would be one issue, or maybe there's some issue with milk cooling down and getting bacteria.
Yeah, exactly right. So it becomes an indicator to make sure you don't burn the baby or make sure you don't give them milk that's soured in some way or not fresh. And so even without kids, you're able to conceptualize that very quickly. And anybody in the world I've ever done this little test with is able to do the same thing. But here's the interesting thing, Nick. What if I had said to you instead, all right, we need to come up with ideas on how not to burn a baby with milk that's too hot. Okay, how long would it take you to come up with a color-changing milk bottle?
Probably half an hour or more.
Okay, half an hour or more? Honestly, maybe never. I'll give you the
I'm
credit.
just being a little bit cocky, I guess, but
That's okay, cocky's fine. But see the difference, even a half hour versus instant, you already have the fluidity to go from the configuration color-changing milk bottle back to its benefit from the solution back to the problem. You have that ability, and we all do. So that's a cornerstone of this method and how it works. Now, what the five patterns do for you is they force your mind to create these configurations. They force your mind to conceptualize a color-changing milk bottle where your mind wasn't likely to have done it on its own. Okay, so you apply the pattern to your mind. It comes up with color-changing milk bottle, and then you go, what would that be useful for? and you create an idea. Okay, you with me?
I am.
Yep. All right, now here's the five patterns. First pattern is called subtraction. I alluded to it before. Subtraction, they sound mathematical, but that's not their basis at all. Subtraction means eliminating a core component, something that you thought was essential, rather than the addition of something new. It's taking something essential away. Task unification. Task unification is taking a component and assigning it an additional job. It has its original job. Now it has an additional job, something it wasn't intended to do, something that at first seemed crazy or absolutely wild. Multiplication. Many innovative products have taken a component and copied the component, but changed it in some qualitative way, counterintuitive, strange way. Once again, to create that strange configuration. Division. Many innovative products have taken the component or the product itself, divided it physically or functionally, and then rearranged it somewhere back into the system. Once again, in a way that at first seemed absurd. And finally, attribute dependency. Many innovative products, in fact, the majority of innovative products, have taken two attributes, one of the product, an attribute of the product, and one of its environment, and created a correlation. As one thing changes, think of transition sunglasses. You know those products? Okay, so the brighter the light gets, the darker the lens gets, a classic attribute dependency. Or windshield wipers that speed up and slow down depending on
the amount of rain. Yeah.
Amount of rain, exactly. A classic attribute dependency. Color changing milk bottle, attribute dependency. And what's true is that as you learn this method and you learn the patterns, you start to look around and realize, oh my God, these patterns are everywhere. They're everywhere. And this is the beauty of it. It's based on science. My co-author's research is among the most respected research. It appeared in the two most prestigious peer-reviewed journals in the world, Nature and Science. And it is a method that by practice is also the one that I believe works better than anything else.
Could you elaborate a little on what exactly the research said? Because I know the people who attend this summit, they love data and they love examples. So how did you actually find out these things?
Yeah. So here's what Jacob's research actually did. And if you go to our book site, I have a website called drewboyd.com, but we also have a book site called insidetheboxinnovation.com. And you can find the link to Jacob's research. It's groundbreaking research, truly is. What he did was looked at highly innovative products, but he looked at two types. This is a subtle but important point. One group of products, innovative products, were successful in the marketplace. Another group of innovative products were failures in the marketplace. They were still innovative, but they were market failures. Many, many great innovative ideas don't succeed necessarily in the marketplace. What he found was this: for the innovative products that were successful in the market, a high percentage of those could be explained by one of the five patterns. Of the failed innovative products, a low percentage of those could be explained by the five patterns. You see the asymmetry?
Can we have an example of one of each? So what classified as a successful innovation compared to a failed innovation?
Well, I can give you an example. Let me try. I can certainly give you an example of successful. I'm less able to think of one that's unsuccessful, but I think I have one in mind. One example of a successful product would be, for example, if you look at automobiles. Automobiles have a lot of these patterns in them. The rear window of your car has wires running through it, right? Now, do you know what those are for, Nick?
They heat up the glass in case of fog or something like that.
Yep. But they also do something else. Do you know what else they do? For many cars, they're the antenna, the radio antenna.
Okay,
so that's a classic example of task unification. Another great example that's in our book is the Sony Walkman. The Sony Walkman is a great story. It was accidental, but it was a great example of subtraction. the vice chairman of Sony wanted to take a player with him to listen to his classical music, but it was bulky. So they had the engineers take the speakers out and the recording function, and all that left is the playback function. It was much smaller and tinier for music on long trips. Well, now think about how crazy that is. You have a tape recorder that has the recording function removed. At the time, it was seems absurd, right? Why would you take the recording function out? Why would you take the speakers out? And it, what it did is it revolutionized music, revolutionized the way we consume music. 200 million Sony Walkmans were sold. It led, of course, to the iPod. It led, of course, to the MP3 revolution. And that, this is how people consume music now.
So, I remember back when I had a Walkman, and I speak to a lot of my colleagues nowadays, and they've never even seen a cassette back in the day.
You don't look that old, so you're kind of dating yourself. You ought to be careful. Yeah. But the so now a failed product. Let me think of one. I just saw one recently. What I do, Nick, was when I see a new product come out, I try to explain it with one of the five patterns. Mm-hmm. If I can't, in my mind, the odds are, according to the data, its chances of success are lower. I'm not saying 100% lower, that it'll absolutely fail, but I wouldn't invest in it. The odds are low. So here's an example. It's a device that a guy out in Seattle created. I spoke to him, young guy that created basically a machine that you place plastic glasses on, and it fills up beer from the bottom. Okay, fills up beer from the bottom.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, and why that is it eliminates the foam. It eliminates the foam on top. The foam and the spillage is costly for the people that buy the beer. It's not costly for the beer makers. They love spillage because it means they're going to sell more beer. Well, that's the reason it failed. It doesn't fall one of the patterns. It was a great idea that just never saw the light of day because the beer makers wanted nothing to do with it. And they refused to back it or endorse it, and they actively went out of their way to keep it from getting into the home. So spillage became a big part of their business model. Imagine if you would lose, just say, let's say 10% spillage from traditional beer pouring in a tap or something like that in a bar or at a sports venue. And so it didn't see the light of day. I look at these patterns as predictors of success. So if you were an investor, a venture capitalist, or an equity, private equity player, you might include these patterns as part of your due diligence, as part of your vetting, popular word now, vetting, and decide if you would want to invest. If you don't see the patterns in these, in their products, in the target's products, run.
So let's try, if we can, to take the listeners and viewers on a journey that sort of exemplifies an example of how you've used these patterns and the SIT methodology in practice. I'm sure there's lots of corporate secrets that you can't talk about, but is there a case study that you can talk about where you actually took a team that was struggling and helped them to find a solution?
Absolutely. Some of these are documented in the book. Let me give you a corporate one and then a, let's say, a less corporate one, but still very telling. The corporate one was with my former company that wanted to expand into the anesthesia business. They made medical devices, so the anesthesia business seemed like a natural adjacency to their business. And they just had this gut feeling that something wasn't quite right. So he asked, he said, "Drew, what do you think we ought to do?" And I said, "Well, Mike, I just read about this guy Goldenberg and his research. It looks very compelling. Why don't we try it? Let's pilot it." And so we did. We piloted a one-day workshop. We took this anesthesia machine and we applied, the first technique we applied was subtraction. Now, here's how this works. This is a machine that would be used in the operating room. The laws, the federal regulations, pretty much everywhere, require a machine like that to have not only a primary power supply, but a backup battery. Because if the power goes out, you would put the patient at risk. Well, this first exercise, the first application of SIT, my very first experience with it, I was in the room, was to imagine eliminating the backup battery. You know, people in the room were screaming. They were hysterical, like, this is a waste of time. It's against the law. And they're all suffering what's called a condition called fixedness. Fixedness is a cognitive bias that makes it hard for us to imagine configurations like color-changing milk bottle or a backup battery-less anesthesia machine. But to be true to the process, you ask yourself, okay, we have all the other components, not just the backup battery. What would be the benefit? Well, it turns out there are lots of benefits. It's lighter, it's cheaper, it's easier to service, it's more reliable. The backup battery takes up most of the footprint. And the engineer told me, he said, Drew, if you really could eliminate the backup battery, the project becomes incredibly simple. So a lot of benefits. Now, with this particular technique, you have to ask yourself, what are the challenges? And is there a way to replace the component with something else, but not the original component? And so they thought about it and they thought about it. And finally, one of the engineers said, well, we could take a cable from another backup battery, say from the defibrillators that revive a patient, and you could connect it to our machine. There's plenty of power on both machines. When that idea came out, the room got so quiet, and they all looked at each other, and they all started to get up. And I go, what are you doing? And they said, we want to go back and prototype it. It's so they had already in their minds figured out the electrical configurations, the volts and watts and ohms, and the length of the cable and the connectors. And so they were able to break fixedness just like that. I use the technique a lot in strategy work. So, for example, I'll tell an organization, we use subtraction and say, imagine you have no sales force. You have everything else. You have all the products. You have all the distributors. You have all the supply chain. You just have no sales reps. What would be the benefit? You ask yourself that first. Well, there's a lot of benefits of having no sales reps. You don't have to train them, hire them, pay them. You don't have to worry about the message getting out wrong. A lot of benefits. But the obvious challenge is, how do you sell? And so it forces them to think about other alternative modes like social media, online, employing reps of other companies, employing different types of configurations, going to different models. And that's what the technique does very nicely, help you conceptualize new business models as well as everyday configurations. But the story, the fun story I want to tell you is when I taught this to third grade kids, which is little people, like, I don't know, maybe 7 or 8 years old, little youngsters. And what I do, Nick, is I teach them the method, and then I want to see them apply it. And so I remember giving this kid named Sam, I gave him this big, bright red University of Cincinnati umbrella. And I said, here, Nick. And his name was Sam, not Nick. You're Nick. I said, here, Sam, here's the umbrella. And I said, what technique do you want to use? And he said, I think I'll use multiplication. And I said, okay. I said, the way multiplication works is you take one of the components, any one, you create a copy, but then you have to change it somehow. It has to be different. I said, Sam, what component do you want to pick? He thought about it. He said, I'm going to pick the handle. I said, okay. And I'm scratching my head. Now I'm thinking, an umbrella with two handles. I didn't quite see it. I said, now the second one has to be different. Sam, what are you going to do? He thought about it. And he goes, I know. I'm going to have a handle here, and I'm going to put a handle on the spike of the umbrella. Now I'm really confused. I'm thinking, I don't see the benefit of this at all. But that's how the method works. You start with color changing the absurd, and then you figure out the benefit. So I say to Sam, okay, Sam, what's the benefit? That's what you have to figure out now. He thinks about it. He thinks, and all of a sudden his eyes get real bright, and he goes, oh, Mr. Boyd, I know. If the umbrella is up and the wind blows it out, you just turn it around, you grab the handle, and you're ready to go. So even in the mind of a third grade child, they were able to conceptualize benefits. And that's what the model, the technique, the method does nicely, is it helps people. It guides them. It forces you to create configurations that your mind won't do on its own because of fixedness.
Drew, it's been absolutely fascinating speaking with you. Before we go, though, could you give anyone listening and watching one sort of piece of actionable advice that if they want to start using the concepts that you've talked about today, what's something they can try out this afternoon?
Yeah, so a couple things. I know you asked for one, but I think the key advice that I give to companies that get intrigued by this is think in terms of a pilot program. A pilot program keeps your risk small, keeps it because there's a lot of psychological risk with innovation. You don't want to look foolish trying something with beanbag chairs and frisbees. And innovation has sort of this tainted image. So you want to do something that if it falls flat on its face and fails, you're not exposed. So a pilot is the way to box in that risk, so to speak, using the box metaphor. So think in terms of a pilot, and I would do a simple technique like subtraction. The way you use it is you take your product or your business and you list out all the components one by one. So the components of a bottle, the cap, the grooves, the little ring here, the label, the bottom, these ridges, you list those all out. And then you systematically remove one at a time and simply ask, okay, not that we're going to, but what would be the benefit? And that simple exercise, deconstructing your product, not sort of unpacking it, will make you look at it differently. And removing one of them will truly change your perspective around your products and services, most likely leading you to an insight you didn't have before. That's the beauty of it. It's fairly easy to practice, like anything, like playing guitar or interviewing guests. It takes practice, and same with this. But you got to start somewhere, and you have to realize that innovation really is a skill that can be learned. It's not some special magical gift you're born with. You can learn to be creative no matter where you're starting from on the creativity scale. And that would be my advice for people.
It's exactly the same advice that I want everyone to take away from the summit. Everyone has creativity and everyone can improve that. And hopefully, listening to experts like yourself, they can take the first steps and actually implement what you're talking about. We're going to get all of the links that you've mentioned in the description and a link to drewboyd.com on the screen as well. So, Drew, thanks so much for being here and I look forward to speaking with you again soon.
I hope so, Nick. All the best to you. Bye-bye.
Congratulations on being part of the Innovation and Creativity Summit. I'm sure that if you continue to watch the other expert interviews, you will experience an improvement in your capability to turn your ideas into something valuable. But don't forget, to get the very best experience and ensure you don't miss any of the priceless lessons, you should invest in yourself with the All Access Pass. Not only will this give you exclusive lifetime access to watch all the lessons whenever is best for you will also get all the interviews as downloadable audio files so you can learn on the go, full transcripts so you can read and analyze the great advice and tips, and exclusive bonuses not available to anyone else. Click the link below to get your All Access Pass now.